Hello, lovely True Crime Dimes. You might have deduced from its title and the fact that it's a true crime podcast that the show will cover potentially upsetting content. In addition to detailed accounts of all manner of horrendous acts, this podcast will also entail the vital and varied use of curse words, BIPOC allyship, love for the LGBTQ+ community, using people's correct pronouns, and other pretty liberal shit. If any of that's going to upset you, exit now. This is Trigger Warning, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Jen O'Malley, and you've been warned. Hey, Dimes. I usually save this until the end of the episode, but I'm really trying to grow the show. If you've enjoyed it so far, it'd help me out tremendously if you'd take the few seconds to just follow or subscribe to the podcast, depending on what platform you use to listen. If you'd like to go the extra mile while you're there, please leave a 5-star review or rating. Thank you so much. Allons-y! Timothy Allen Schuster was born on Thursday, April 24th, 1958 in Golden, Illinois. He finished high school in 1976 and went on to Southeastern Community College in Iowa. While going to school, he was employed at Carthage Hospital as an emergency medical technician. He graduated in 1980 and began his career with Boone County Hospital in Columbia, Missouri. It was during this time that Tim met Larissa Foreman, a biochemistry major at the University of Missouri, Columbia. On Saturday, August 7th, 1982, they were married. Tim and Larissa had their first child, daughter Kristen, in 1985, and their second child, son Tyler, in 1990. They'd moved to Fresno, California around 1988 when Larissa was offered a high-paying position with an agricultural research lab, and Tim found a position in the cardiac unit at St. Agnes Hospital. Tim also completed his Bachelor of Nursing degree at Chapman University in Orange. Larissa realized that the lab she worked for was tanking. She decided it was the right time to start her own, and in 1998, Central California Research Labs was born. By 2001, Larissa was the primary earner for the family and a workaholic, putting in the time it took for her company to become a multi-million dollar success. Tim, while still working full-time as an administrator at the hospital, was the primary caregiver for the children and the home, which he reportedly loved. It's widely agreed upon that Larissa was a forceful woman, some prefer domineering, and Tim was a mild-mannered man who didn't like conflict. Some of Larissa's former employees variously described her as very controlling, cruel and vindictive, intimidating, unable to control her temper, and a scary lady to work for. At the hospital where he helped run the nursing department, Tim was a popular leader. The other nurses liked him and looked up to him. His daughter described him as a big old teddy bear. At home, Larissa's word was law, and everyone just went along with it. Well, as teenage daughters are wont to do, Kristen eventually stopped going along with it. She defied her mom in the typical ways, breaking curfew, talking back, sneaking out. For an always-in-charge person like Larissa, it was unacceptable behavior. Although Tim opposed the decision, opposed may be too strong of a word for a personality like Tim's, let's say didn't support. Larissa packed up Kristen and sent her to live with her grandparents in Missouri. This may have been the tipping point for a marriage that was already festering. As I mentioned, Tim was incredibly passive, infuriatingly so, as far as Larissa was concerned. Tim's coworkers and friends of the couple, Bob and Mary Solis, told Dateline that it was obvious that she didn't mind embarrassing him in front of his friends. She didn't mind that at all. In fact, she took relish in that at times. She'd insult and belittle him at every opportunity. Larissa would tell anyone who'd listen that Tim wasn't a real man, which is a phrase I detest, and even claimed to have had an affair in 1993 just to get a reaction out of him. She would openly discuss his supposed impotence while simultaneously complaining that he wouldn't have sex with her. And given the way she treated him, I can't be alone in saying, well, no fucking wonder. But all that passivity stopped when, after almost 20 years of marriage, Larissa filed for divorce in February of 2002. Bob said, Tim was changing. He was evolving, and he was changing to a point where he was starting to get some stones. Although he was reluctant at first to do it, he was slowly progressing to a point where he was starting to say no. In one of those first instances of standing up for himself, according to Deadly Women Volume 4 by Robert Keller, Tim insisted that he remain in the family home until a settlement could be reached regarding the division of their shared assets. The couple began sleeping in separate rooms until the animosity between them eventually drove Tim out. He left in July of 2002 while Larissa was in Missouri visiting family, and she was livid when she got back. Larissa was so pissed, in fact, that in August, she and James Fagoni, a 20-year-old man who worked at her lab, babysat her son, and did other errand boy stuff, broke into Tim's new home. They stole property Tim and Larissa had shared, plus some electronics for James, deleted a document that Tim had been using to show his involvement with Tyler for custody purposes — things had gotten really nasty by this point, if you couldn't tell — and ransacked the condo. Like, took a knife to the bedding, ransacked. Larissa told several people that she'd done it, even telling her manicurist, "I saw what I did and it just gave me this orgasm that was better than sex." What a dumb bitch. Tim knew, of course, who'd robbed him, and reported it, but it seems that Fresno police never really pursued it. Tim moved to a house in Clovis that was equipped with an alarm system and motion sensors, plus got a gun and a concealed carry permit. This may seem like a bit much, but unsurprisingly, Larissa had been shooting off her big mouth. Here's a fun little list of what she had to say according to court documents. She told a neighbor that she sometimes thought she should just kill Tim and be done with it. She told her manicurist that she prayed every night that Tim would die. She asked her employee, Leslie Dobbs, if her boyfriend knew anyone who could rough up somebody. She told a member of her church choir that she would do everything in her power to keep Tim from getting the business. She asked the barbecue repairman if he would go to Tim's house, stun him to the ground with a stun gun when he answered the door, and then flag her down, where she would be waiting a couple of houses away. She asked a lab employee if he thought a body would fit in the 55-gallon barrel she purchased in April. A couple of times, Larissa told this same employee that if she could kill Tim and get away with it, she would. She once asked if the employee knew anyone who would rough up Tim or kill him. And she told her manicurist that she could kill Tim and get away with it, and that she knew people who could do it. Again, I say, what a truly dumb bitch. But also, somebody come get these other folks. All this craziness, and not one person said anything. Just a note to any of my coworkers listening, if you repeatedly tell me that you'd like or are going to kill your spouse, or anyone else for that matter, please know that I'm absolutely going to report that shit. One time's a joke. Several times is a big-ass red flag. If that wasn't enough, Larissa had also been harassing Tim, leaving him vicious, ugly messages like, "I hate your fucking guts so bad I can't even stand you. I hope you burn in hell." You know what? Those mixing bowls are mine, so I expect to find all four of those returned. And if you don't, I'm going to call the fucking cops. And I'm going to come and get it. Do you hear me, you fucking faggot? I will tell you one thing, if that ever happens again, you're dead. You materialistic fucking faggot bastard. That's what you are. That's all you give a shit about, is what you're gonna get out of this. Answer the phone, you fucker. I hope to God you burn in hell one of these days, because you will, you and your bitch mom. You're such a wimp. You have no spine. Have a great day, you son of a bitch. Oh, you wanna talk about mothers? That's a white chick's reference, but talking about somebody's mama like that'll get you hurt. And the F slur? No, ma'am. Plus, they were married for almost 20 years, and California is a community property state. It sounds like if anyone was worried about who's going to get what in the divorce, it was her. In the midst of this absolute shit show, bless his heart, Tim was laid off from St. Agnes on Wednesday, July 9th, 2003. Mary was too. Bob, Mary, Tim, and Tim's best friend Vic Uribe Jr. had dinner together that evening. With everything going on, when the notably meticulous, notoriously punctual Tim didn't show up the next day for a breakfast date with the Solises, nor a meeting with human resources about his severance, some people might have assumed he'd just had enough, that he'd reached his limit. But his friends knew better. They were worried for him, so Bob and Mary called Vic to stop by Tim's house. No one answered the door when Vic arrived. Letting himself in, nothing seemed amiss at first, but best friends know things, y'all. Vic noticed that dishes from the night before were in the sink, which was completely out of character for Tim. When he got to the bedroom, Vic found Tim's watch and cell phone on the nightstand. He went to the garage, where he found Tim's truck, his wallet inside, He immediately knew something was horribly wrong, and the friends went to the police. The Solises were told they had to wait, say it with me, Dimes, 24 hours before they could file a missing person report. If your eyes didn't just roll so far back into your head that they hurt a little bit, you must be new to true crime. I know I'm not the first person to point this out, but there's literally a show called The First 48, and you want to waste half of that off the bat because adults are free to come and go as they please? Kiss the entirety of my ass. And I'm aware that I'm being a little more ranty than usual, but this case really pisses me off. I don't know if it's because Larissa thinks she's so damn smart when she is clearly fucking up left and right, or if it's because she's such a loudmouth C-word. Mama, I typically would have rolled with that name, but I don't want you to wreck. Or if it's because she pronounces her name Larissa instead of Larissa and it's annoying as fuck. Either way, the whole thing just aggravates the shit out of me. Moving on. When detectives Vincent Weber and Larry Kirkhart entered Tim's home on Friday, July 11th, they found Tim's gun shoved under the cushion of a chair and damaged to the wall behind that chair, like it had been pushed up against it too hard. In the same room, they found a microcassette recorder and tape. That's like the voice recorder on your phone, youngins. It seems Tim was keeping a record of the nasty messages Larissa had sent. The caller ID on the landline showed that the last call received was at 2:02 a.m. the day that Tim went missing. It was from Larissa's cell. The detectives arranged for Larissa to come in to talk about Tim. She started running her giant mouth with TMI as soon as she got in there. If you want some homework, I highly recommend watching Season 1, Episode 4 of Deadly Wives for a sassy look at this case, particularly Larissa's completely cringe initial interview with police. It's on YouTube. After more than an hour of her yapping away, Detective Wiebert asked her why she'd called Tim in the wee hours on the morning he'd disappeared. She claimed that she'd fallen asleep and butt-dialed Tim because he was on speed dial in her phone. Detective Wiebert asked if she had her phone with her, but she said it was at home. Working off a hunch, Detective Wiebert went out to the parking lot and saw a cell phone sitting in the center console of Larissa's Lexus. He dialed the number he'd pulled from Tim's caller ID, and the phone in the car rang. He went back inside and asked Larissa to get her phone out of her car. She did, and he went through each of her speed dial numbers. None of them were for Tim, and she'd been caught in a lie, to which she later admitted. During the interview, Detective Wiebert had also noticed something he was familiar with from domestic abuse cases he'd worked. Three small, half-moon-shaped marks on Larissa's leg. The detective knew it was from someone's nails as they forcibly grabbed her. Despite feeling sure that Larissa was involved in Tim's disappearance, she was free to go. Tammy Belcher, Larissa's friend, called her the next morning, Saturday. Tammy said of Larissa, she felt that the phone was bugged, and so she said, "I cannot talk about it. Can you come over here?" When Tammy got there, Larissa explained what had happened at the police station, and Tammy informed her that the next step would probably be a search warrant, to which Larissa responded, "Well, they can't do that. I'm going out of town on Sunday. They can't serve me." Tammy corrected her friend's misconception, informing Larissa that the police could execute the warrant without her being there and without her permission, and that they could get one for her lab, too. Tammy says that Larissa abruptly asked her to watch Tyler so that she could go to the lab right then and take care of some bills and payroll. Smooth like butter, this one. Enter Leslie Dobbs, the chemist I mentioned earlier, the one Larissa asked if her boyfriend knew anyone who could rough somebody up. Leslie went to the police on Monday, July 14th, to let them know that on Saturday, Larissa had asked her to rent a U-Haul truck in her name. Leslie's, not Larissa's. This wasn't the first time Larissa had asked her to rent something in her name. The year before, Leslie had rented a storage unit, A182, at Security Public Storage on Shaw Avenue, for Larissa, presumably so she could hide some items from Tim that she didn't think he was entitled to in the divorce. And, oh yeah, the giant blue barrel that had been in the lab for months was gone. Police got search warrants for the storage unit, the lab, and Larissa's house. Before they even got to the storage unit itself, the smell hit them. They put on breathing apparatus and gloves and entered the unit. In the back corner, under some Christmas decorations and surrounded by cardboard, was a 55-gallon blue barrel, the source of the nauseous stench. What did they find, my darling Dimes? The barrel was just about full of some sort of thick liquid, the poor soul who opened it recalls. The lower half of a human body was floating inside. DNA tests would confirm that they'd found Tim Schuster. While police worked on an arrest warrant and extradition order for Larissa, who was vacationing with Tyler, police brought in James Fagoni, and he cracked. On Wednesday, July 9th, 2013, James and Larissa went to Tim's house. James stood out of sight while Larissa went directly up the walk and called Tim, telling him that Tyler wasn't feeling well and she needed him to come to the door. Tim carried his gun with him, but seeing only Larissa on the other side of the door, he shoved the gun under the chair cushion and opened up. They rushed him, and James shot Tim several times with the stun gun he'd brought, the stun gun Larissa had given him money to buy. The gun apparently wasn't doing much, as Tim shouted, "Hey, what's going on?" and struggled. He fell back, forcefully hitting the chair. James put him in a headlock, and Larissa applied a chloroform-soaked rag to Tim's face. Once he'd passed out, the pair used zip ties on Tim's wrists and ankles. They put Tim in his own truck and headed to Larissa's. She drove Tim's truck, which she pulled into her garage, while James drove hers and parked in the driveway. They put Tim into the blue barrel head first. James said during his interrogation that Tim was moaning, indicating that he was still alive, and started pouring in hydrochloric acid. According to Detective Wiebert, that means that while he's in the barrel and she's pouring the acid on him, he's either dying as a result of aspiration of the acid fumes or from actual immersion in the acid. You can't fathom somebody actually dying like that. It just seems like it would be so painful and horrible. Dr. Myron F. Goodman, head of the Molecular Biology Division at the University of Southern California, explained that having hydrochloric acid poured on you while you're still alive is one of the most painful ways to die. It would burn like hell, Goodman said. It would denature every protein and cause a huge burning sensation. You'd be dead in no time, but you'd suffer horribly on the way. Due to the fumes, Larissa could only stand to pour two or three containers of the acid into the barrel before sealing the lid. They used a dolly to move the barrel to a shed in Larissa's side yard and rolled it inside. The pair wiped down Tim's truck, and then James drove it back to Tim's garage. Do you see anything wrong with the order of operations there, Dimes? Larissa followed in her vehicle, told James to go inside and tidy up, then drove him back to her house. James rode Tyler's bike down the street to the house where he lived with his parents. The night of Larissa's initial conversation with police, she was worried and wanted to get Tim's body out of her shed. She called James over so they could move it to the lab, along with some additional bottles of hydrochloric acid. They drove there separately and used another dolly to bring the barrel inside, then retrieve the acid. Larissa opened the barrel to add more acid. When she tried to close it, Tim's feet were in the way. She used a hacksaw to cut his feet until she could snap the ankles over. Even then, she was still having trouble getting the lid closed, so James stood on top of the barrel to help. The next day, Saturday, July 12th, 2003, was when Larissa had Tammy come over and abruptly left for the lab. She called Leslie in to rent the U-Haul for her and then moved the barrel to the storage unit. Later that evening, Larissa called James and told him to come over. He threw the stun gun in a porta potty on the way. She told him she'd moved the barrel to the storage unit and had taken care of everything. She left for vacation the next morning. So now we're back to Monday, July 14th. James Fagoni was arrested. During searches by police, a can of Lysol air freshener was found on a refrigerator inside the lab. Such a product would not be used in the lab for fear of contaminating the analyses being performed. Toward the bottom of the dumpster in a locked enclosure behind the lab was a case of 6 empty bottles of hydrochloric acid. Typically, no more than a bottle or two were needed by the lab in a year. Forensic analysis of Larissa's office computer showed that on June 13th, internet searches were conducted for the terms acid digestion tissues, acid digestion animal tissues, and sulfuric acid. When Larissa was arrested at the St. Louis airport on Wednesday, July 16th, she had 2 receipts from a store about halfway between her lab and the storage unit. Both showed purchases made just after 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, July 12th, including Lysol and other air fresheners. Also in Larissa's possession was a card with storage facility entry instructions and a code number. Once more with feeling. What a dumb bitch. As expected, Larissa claimed that James murdered Tim on his own and that she just helped hide the body afterward. James claimed that he was terrified of Larissa and did whatever she told him for fear that she'd hurt him or his family. They were tried separately, and neither jury believed either of these dumbasses. James was convicted of first-degree murder and first-degree burglary. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole and ordered to pay restitution, as well as various fees and fines. Larissa Schuster was convicted of first-degree murder with special circumstances of financial gain and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Kristen, her daughter, said in her victim impact statement, "So this is goodbye, not just for now, but for good. This is goodbye as your daughter." Larissa's appeals were unsuccessful, but you probably aren't surprised to find out that this wench had the audacity to request clemency from the governor of California in 2021. A cry for mercy from the person who dissolved half of her husband, the father of her children, in a vat of acid. And I have to share with you the absolutely delusional statements she made in 2020 when she was part of a YouTube series called Stories from the Penitentiary. I'm going to read this almost verbatim, so please excuse the total overuse of variations of the phrase, she said. Larissa wrote that she has done very well here in prison and has had no problems. "I don't fit in and don't ever intend to," she wrote. She said that she took a position at the penitentiary in the Peer Health Education Office, giving presentations on communicable diseases. She also says she educated the inmates about prison rape when they entered the facility. Larissa said she left those jobs in August 2019 to begin studying to become a certified alcohol and drug counselor. "Once I complete the education, I have to do 255 hours of practice, and then I can sit for my certification exam," she said. "I will be able to use a certification out in the community, hopefully one day when I can get a chance at parole." She said she's allowed to use a computer in Chowchilla because "I have demonstrated that I am trustworthy and honest." Trustworthy and honest, y'all. Make it stop. Larissa is making an afghan for her son's first child, taught herself to play the guitar in prison, and plays Christian music and performs at church services. She wants to spend time with her children and grandkids on her first day if she's ever granted freedom. "Prison is a temporary place for me," she wrote. "At least now I understand more about what happened to me to make the horrible decisions I made." About what happened to her. The unmitigated narcissism of it all. I don't see that Governor Newsom granted her request, but I also can't find any confirmation that it was denied. That's it for today, y'all. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. It's quick and easy to do. I appreciate you. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, Dimes.